Chapter 12. Then. Lana stepped out of the bank and moved along the street, passing vendors selling cooked meats and grilled corn on the cob. The Blue was currently moored in Tiron, a busy town on the eastern edge of the Philippines that was to be their last port. They'd already been here for 10 days, and everyone was growing impatient as they waited for a weather window to make their passage to Palau. It would be a 1,500 nautical mile ocean crossing, which would take around a week in good conditions, longer if the wind turned fickle. Lana had come into town to withdraw the next week's payment for her and Kitty. They took it in turns to pay each week, and having checked their balance, Lana was disheartened to see they'd only be able to afford another couple of months with the crew, unless they came up with some way of making money. Kitty had already threatened to take out a loan if needs be, saying, "A little detail like money isn't going to be parting me from the Blue." Town felt crowded and noisy after the yacht, and the smell of sewage and strong spices assaulted her senses. Even though it was still early, the heat was already building, and she could feel the back of her dress beginning to cling to her skin. She passed an ice cream seller and decided to cheer herself up with a cone of homemade mango ice cream. She stepped from the busy main street into the entrance of an alley, where she ate in the shade, leaning her back against the wall. As she was standing there, Lana saw Aaron exiting an internet cafe. His laptop was under one arm, and he was pulling down his cap with his other hand. He turned, saying something to the person following behind. "Denny." Lana found herself smiling as she watched Denny, taking in the way his shorts were just a little too big for him and hung boyishly from his hips. She was about to step forward and say hello, but something made her hesitate. Aaron was striding on, his right hand balled into a fist at his side, and Denny, who was hurrying to keep up, seemed to be trying to say something, his hands opening in front of him. It looked as if they were arguing. Denny was partially obscured by a man carrying a crate of empty glass bottles, but she could see the heightened colour in Aaron's face as they neared. She caught his voice rising above the street noise. "I fucking knew it. I fucking knew it. I said all along." "Listen, Aaron, we don't know for sure." The rest of Denny's sentence was lost to a tricycle whizzing by, tinny pop music blaring. Suddenly Aaron stopped and turned sharply to face Denny, the flow of people having to move around them. Lana pressed herself back against the wall. She could feel the drip of melted ice cream on the back of her hand, but didn't move to lick it off. She remained still, staring at the profiles of both men. Aaron's neck was a furious red, the veins prominent. Denny's brows were furrowed together as he listened. "I can't be here any longer," Aaron said, his teeth clamped tight around his words.
"What do you want to do?"
Denny asked. "Leave. I can't still be fucking around in port, just waiting for it. I've got to be on the water by the 15th. You know that." Denny reached out and placed a hand on Aaron's shoulder. He held it there, applying a firm pressure. "I know," he said slowly. "I know." Aaron nodded once, turned from Denny and marched on. Lana heard Denny sigh as he thrust his hands deep into his shorts pockets, shaking his head. He stood for a moment, watching until Aaron disappeared. Then he turned in the other direction and was swallowed once again by the crowd. When Lana returned to the yacht an hour or so later, the place was buzzing with activity. Denny was pulling the cushions from the saloon seats and checking the equipment stored beneath. Aaron was sitting at the nav station looking through the charts. Heinrich was kneeling on the floor with parts of the spare water pump in pieces in front of him. Shell and Kitty were pulling out some of the dry goods from the cupboards and decanting them into smaller containers in the galley.
"What's going on?" Lana asked Kitty.
"We're leaving for Palau this evening."
"What? I thought the forecast wasn't looking good."
"It's improved," Aaron said. "Looks like the nor'easterlies are easing, blowing 10 to 15 knots now. Plus, There's a low-pressure system arriving in 2 to 3 days that looks likely to hang around a while. If we don't go now, we could end up being in port another fortnight, maybe more. It's getting too near typhoon season to risk setting out much later. Lana thought about the conversation between Denny and Aaron that she'd overheard, guessing it had something to do with this sudden decision. I can't still be fucking around, just waiting for it. I've got to be on the water by the 15th, you know that. Be prepared for a busy afternoon, Aaron said to the crew. We need to fill up the water tank, refuel, provision, and clear out of immigration. Shell and Heinrich, you're in charge of buying dry goods, and Lana and Kitty, you'll do the fresh produce. He handed out lists written in a neat masculine script. Denny, I need you to get across town and pick up some spare water containers and batteries. We'll all meet back here at 1600 hours, ready to go to immigration. He looked at the crew. Everyone clear? Without waiting for an answer, Aaron returned to his charts, a deep frown of concentration lining his face. When Denny left the saloon, Lana followed him up onto deck. She watched him for a few moments as he concentrated on unclipping the large canopy over the boom, ready to stow it for passage. His movements were sharp and hurried, and she could see the tension in his jaw as he struggled with one of the clips. Hey, she said behind him. He turned, startled. On seeing her, he smiled, his expression softening a little. Want a hand? Sure. Together they unclipped the rest of the canopy. The midday sun was fierce, and Lana could feel the heat tingling over her shoulders as they finished removing the canopy, shaking it out over the side of the yacht. As they folded it away, Lana said, I saw you and Aaron in town earlier, coming out of that internet place. Did you? It looked like something was up. Denny kept his attention fixed on the canopy. All's good. Lana glanced towards the hatch to check no one was coming. How did the forecast look to you? Are you happy it's the right time to leave? Aaron knows what he's doing, Denny said, taking the canopy from her, a slight rebuke in his tone. Denny, she said, stepping forward and placing a hand on his forearm so that he looked up, facing her. She lowered her voice as she asked, Is everything okay? Really? In town, Aaron looked, I don't know, troubled. And now, all of a sudden, we're leaving. It's not sudden, Lana. We've been waiting to leave for almost a fortnight. Now the forecast has come good, so we're going. A brightly painted banker motored by, trailing a cloud of dark fumes. Its wake knocked against the blue, gently rocking them from side to side. Shouldn't there have been a group vote on it? On whether to set sail? That's always the skipper's call. The rest of us haven't studied the charts or forecasts to be able to make that decision. It was a fair point. Denny was the next most experienced crew member on board, and she knew he had an instinctive, intuitive approach to the sea. She'd noticed the way Aaron would seek out Denny's opinion, listening closely to what he said. If you think it's the right decision, then I'm happy with it too, she said, leaning forward and placing a kiss on his neck. Denny's gaze moved from her to the hatch. Lana turned and saw Kitty standing there. Ready to get these provisions? She said, coolly. They took the dinghy to shore in silence. Once they got into town, Lana struggled to keep up as Kitty ducked around the back of a tricycle, then followed a narrow rubble path between two buildings where the stifling air smelt of chicken muck and spices. Once the fruit market was in sight, Kitty said, I'll meet you there. I just need to pick up a couple of things. She peeled away before Lana had a chance to ask any questions. The fruit and vegetable stalls stood shoulder to shoulder beneath a dusty white awning. She moved into the shaded, sweet-scented air, browsing the beautifully displayed produce. Huge bunches of deep yellow bananas hung from the tops of the stalls. Crates of watermelons hunkered together. Squat pears were neatly placed in white nets. She filled several bags with fresh vegetables and deliciously ripe fruit, as per Aaron's list. It was only when she was leaving that Kitty rejoined her. "Sorry, had a few shopping requests from the others," Kitty said, glancing down at the bag in her hand, which was clinking with bottles. Lana said nothing. Since their row at the beach fire, it felt as though a barrier had gone up between them. Sensing Kitty's disapproval about Denny, Lana had been wary of mentioning his name. Yesterday, she and Denny had gone to pick up a spare part for one of the bilge pumps, and had a couple of hours to themselves. They'd enjoyed lunch at a dusty roadside place, where they'd sat, with their hands linked, across the table, talking and laughing. When she returned to the yacht, she'd been desperate to tell Kitty about her day, but there was such frostiness in Kitty's tone as she'd asked, "Had a good time, did you?" that Lana decided it would be best to keep quiet. They walked in silence to the wet market, the fetid smell of the place drifting downwind towards them before they'd even reached it. Set at the edge of the harbour, the building was open-sided with a tin roof. Long stone benches ran the length of it and were covered with melting ice. An eye-boggling array of fish and meat was on display, and flies swarmed in the air. Lana's flip-flops squelched through the blood-inked water as they peered at the fresh, glassy eyes of the fish. Ahead of her, a slight Filipino man weighed out fish in two buckets that were attached to a pole balanced over his shoulder. All around, people shouted and haggled, prodding and sniffing the fish, then filling plastic bags they held at their sides. They wouldn't buy fish, as the crew preferred to catch their own, so instead they moved on to the meat section, advertised by the bloodied head of a pig hanging on a hook. Dark, congealed livers were laid out beside whole pink chickens that were still bearing a few feathers. Lana asked for four chickens, pointing at the ones she wanted. A man wearing a blood-smeared apron slung them on the scales. "Cut," she nodded, and they watched as each chicken was slapped onto a plastic chopping board and then set upon with a meat cleaver, separating the wings, breasts, legs. A fragment of bone flicked into the air and landed on the floor between her and Kitty. As they waited, Kitty asked, "So, what's happening between the two of you?" "Denny and me," she said, surprised by the question. "I'm not sure. I guess things are good." She turned to look at Kitty, but her gaze was fixed on the meat. "I like him, Kit," Lana said gently. "Are you going to speak to Aaron about it?" "I suppose we'll have to eventually, if we want to be open about things." "Is that what Denny wants?" Kitty asked, turning to face her. "What do you mean?" Kitty said nothing. Lana didn't like the implication in the question. "Yes," she answered tightly. "It's what Denny wants too." The man finished slicing the chickens. When Lana handed over the money, he took it in his bloodied hands and rummaged in his pocket for the change, returning it to Lana with a glob of blood on it. Back at the yacht, they began unpacking, placing the fruit in hammocks that hung bulging from the galley ceiling, and storing the meat in the freezer. Kitty slipped off, taking one of the bags to her cabin. Shell was putting away the dried goods, pasta, rice, lentils, tins of beans, and vegetables, into the lockers under the saloon seating. They had to store more food than needed for the anticipated passage, in case there were problems. "Plan for the worst and hope for the best," was Aaron's motto. "Did you hear?" Shell said. "Joseph's not coming on the passage." "What?" Lana said, pausing. "He's in his cabin, packing." "He's leaving today." "Why?" Lana asked, shocked. "When was this decided? Was there a vote?" "No. It was Joseph's decision, apparently. Aaron said he's run out of money.
Lana left the shopping and walked down the passageway to Joseph's cabin. She found him pushing a neat bundle of clothes into his canvas backpack.
What's going on? I've heard you're leaving.
You hear right?
Why? She asked. He shrugged.
My money is run out.
She shook her head.
But I thought you said you had enough money to reach New Zealand.
We'd been talking about it only a week or two ago.
He shrugged. Maybe I do my numbers incorrectly.
It was almost impossible to overspend on the yacht, as they kept to a strict budget for food and fuel, and the only additional things you had to pay for were personal items or alcohol. Lana pulled the door shut behind her.
Really, Joseph, why are you leaving?
He looked at her squarely. There was something completely unreadable in his eyes.
I already tell you.
Does Denny know? He nodded.
What are you going to do now?
I will think of something.
Lana looked at him closely. She realized how thin he'd become, his face gaunt and unshaven.
Is everything okay? I have some money. Maybe I can help.
He smiled.
You are a very good person, but no, I will not take your money.
But I thought you loved being on the blue.
I love the horizon. An empty sea.
I'll be sad to see you go.
She enjoyed their chats while they sat at the bow under the stars, Joseph smoking and telling her stories of little-known French poets, or about the subtle difference between platform diving and cliff diving. Lana liked the dips and curves of their conversations, his thoughtful pauses, the sudden spurt of talk on a subject she knew little of.
"Clearing out in 5 minutes,"
Aaron bellowed from the saloon.
"It is not sad for everyone," Joseph said with a raised eyebrow.
"Is it Aaron? Did something happen?"
Joseph didn't answer. "I should finish packing."
"But when are you leaving?"
"I go in the dinghy to shore with you all."
It all felt wrong, too sudden. She'd have liked to have cooked a final supper so the crew could give Joseph a proper send-off. It was too rushed. She imagined him leaving the yacht, having to check into a guest house with his canvas backpack slung over his shoulders. A group of trendy young travellers looking at him, then at each other with sly smiles.
"Let me write down your email address so we can keep in touch."
"I don't use email."
"But how will we know you're okay?"
she asked, thinking of how Joseph had been sleeping rough before joining the blue. Joseph looked at her, then smiled.
"I am always okay."
The crew said goodbye to Joseph in a rush at the town jetty, Aaron and Heinrich already walking ahead in the direction of the immigration office. Shell and Kitty kissed Joseph goodbye, giving him strict instructions to carry on diving. Denny pulled him into a big hug, and Joseph said something in French that made Denny's whole face break into a smile. When Lana hugged Joseph, he felt desperately thin beneath his t-shirt. She didn't want to let him go, feeling as if they were somehow letting him down.
"We'll miss you."
Joseph said nothing, just laughed his strange, sad laugh. He shrugged on his backpack, which looked so heavy and full on his frame that his shoulders rounded beneath its weight. Lana watched him go, unsettled that his departure had been so sudden and unmarked. He looked somehow vulnerable as he trudged away into the heat and crowds. She remained standing there until Denny came to her side, squeezing her fingers between his and asking, "You okay?" She nodded slowly. Then after a moment, they walked on and rejoined the others. The atmosphere at immigration was muted. Aaron had already cleared the boat out of the country with customs and the port authority, so now all they had to do was fill in a form each and have their passports stamped. What could have taken not much more than 20 minutes was dragged out to take over an hour, as the staff casually followed their usual procedures
while chatting to each other. Aaron kept checking his watch, eager to get back to the yacht to catch the outgoing tide. Eventually they were back on board, winching the dinghy up from the water and stowing it away for the passage at sea. Final checks of supplies and equipment were made, and loose items were stowed away or strapped down. When Aaron was satisfied that everything was in order, they started the engine and hauled anchor. Lana sat at the stern, watching over her shoulder as the busy harbour town faded into the distance. She wondered whether Joseph would be sitting in a bar, smoking as he watched the blue sail off into the dusk. She gazed at the wake created by the yacht, a spell of white rolling across the sea's surface, trying to follow the lines of white water, watching until they levelled and knitted back together again. The metallic taste of blood shivered across her tongue. She looked down and realised she was biting the edge of her thumbnail and had ripped away the rough skin at its edge. She snatched her hands from her mouth and pressed them against her knees. A sharpening sense of anxiety was building in her chest, triggered by Aaron's abrupt decision to set sail and the strange and sudden way Joseph had left the yacht. It was almost as if something was being kept from her, but she couldn't say what. When Lana looked up again, she saw that the town had begun to shrink into the distance. Soon it would be no more than a shadow behind them as they headed for the open sea. Chapter 13. Now. Lana stares at the doorway through which Denny's parents have just left. What does Paul Carter want to talk to them about that couldn't be said in public? She thinks of the body the search and rescue team located, with the EPIRB strapped to it, and has to squeeze her eyes shut against the thought that it could be him. "What's going on?" Shell's mother asks, her voice edged with anxiety. Her husband answers, "Perhaps they just want to talk to him about the boat." Lana cannot wait in here with speculation and guesswork breeding more anxiety. She leaves Shell's parents in the waiting room and moves along the corridor looking for Paul Carter. She walks in the direction of the operations room, glancing through the open doorways as she goes. Somewhere ahead of her, she is sure she can hear his voice. A moment later, she spots him standing in a small room at the end of the corridor, facing Denny's parents. Lana presses herself against the wall so as not to be seen. Although she cannot hear what is being said, she watches intently. Paul Carter shifts from foot to foot as he touches his moustache. He looks at the floor, then at Denny's father. He does not look at Denny's mother. He says something, turning his palms skywards, shaking his head. Denny's mother, who has been standing with her hands held in a prayer, the tips of her fingers resting against her lips, suddenly folds. Her body doubles over, and she covers her head with her hands. Denny's father doesn't move a millimetre. He stares straight ahead, as if he's frozen. "Not Denny, please, not Denny." Lana feels the blood drain out of her as she watches the awful tableau ahead. Denny's mother is still bent forwards, as if Paul Carter's words have sliced straight through her core and she can no longer stand upright. Then, as though a pause button has suddenly been released, sound and movement flare to life. Denny's mother rears upright, whirling around on the spot, her arms flung out at her sides. Lana catches sight of her face and is shocked by the way pain has twisted her features. "My boy," she howls, her hands curling into fists. Her husband moves then, gathering her in his arms. She struggles and writhes, fighting his hold. Over and over again he tells her, "I've got you. I've got you. I've got you, Marge." Eventually she goes limp in his arms. The awful wail of tears and grief chokes from her throat, the sound threading along the corridor until it reaches Lana, twisting at her gut. Paul Carter stays for another minute or two, saying something that Lana can't hear. Eventually he nods solemnly and leaves. Lana's skin feels too hot. She cannot breathe. She needs to move.
get away from here. Yet she stays as she is, pressed against the wall. Paul Carter is moving towards her now, the heavy tread of his footsteps approaching. It is only when he is almost upon her that he looks up and sees her. His face is grey, eyes unfocused. It takes him a moment to place her. Lana. He turns and looks back over his shoulder towards Denny's parents. He's dead. It was his body with the EPIRB, wasn't it? Paul Carter looks at her levelly. I'm terribly sorry. He goes to say something else, but she is already turning, moving away from him, hurrying down the corridor, pushing open the fire exit with the heels of her hands. She sprints across the courtyard and rushes to the side of the dock, falling onto her hands and knees. She retches into the harbour, bile swirling with oil-slick water. Later, Lana wanders the port, following the concrete harbour edge, skirting the huge steel cleats that tether ships to land. The news of Denny's death is so fresh, so surreal, that she doesn't feel it yet. Not fully. It's as if the information is suspended, just hovering in the air above her. When she thinks of him, it's impossible to picture his body face down in the sea, clothes waterlogged and dark, his beautiful hands limp at his sides. Instead, what she sees is the Denny she first knew, with his head angled towards her, the sun in his eyes, grinning. How could that person, the one who'd slipped his hand into hers in a cave of limestone, who'd trod water beside her in the moonlight, who'd placed his lips at the base of her throat, be dead? She remembers an afternoon in the Philippines, when they hired a moped to explore the far side of an island where they'd moored. The rest of the crew were content to stay with the yacht, so it was just the two of them, cruising along the narrow tracks of hardened earth, and through fields where the long grasses whipped at Lana's bare legs. "Okay, back there," Denny called, as they sped forward, verdant scents rising from the sun-warmed earth. The track ascended up a rutted path, and Lana tightened her grip around Denny's waist. She remembers the heat of his body and the hard muscles of his stomach. With the sun on her back and the warmth of Denny in front of her, she leant her cheek against him and closed her eyes, feeling an overwhelming sense of contentment. Until today, she's not let herself think of memories like these. Not for a long time. But now they burn bright across her thoughts, like shooting stars. Beautiful, but vanishing. She wonders about Denny's parents. How do you get in your car, drive home and carry on with life, when your son is supposed to be sitting beside you on that journey? Had his mother stocked the fridge with his favourite foods and made up his old bed for him? Had they arranged to go out for a welcome home dinner with friends and relatives? She walks on, passing a tower block of shipping containers in rusted blues and reds. The stack looms above her, thuggish and indifferent. She tries to picture one of these containers slipping off the back of a ship, drifting alone through the oceans, its huge metal bulk lurking just below the surface. She imagines the blue cutting through the waves, the wind straining in her sails, and suddenly there's an almighty impact, a clawing metallic groan, an alarming shudder that sends the crew flying across the deck. She wonders whether any of them were injured or thrown overboard with the impact. At what point did the EPIRB get thrown into the grab bag on Denny's back? Was he wearing it as he tried to get on the life raft? Did he run out of time? She moves on past the containers, pausing only when she reaches the edge of the port. She places her feet at the lip of the concrete dock and looks down. The water is a bluish brown, filmed with diesel. She thinks of the beautiful bays they sailed to in the Philippines, where the water was so clear she could see the coral beneath her. She wants to go back. Back to those heady first weeks on board, when the yacht was a sanctuary, a world away from real life, filled with easy laughter and good friends. Back to when she and Kitty would laugh together in their cabin with the ease of sisters.
back to when Denny would pass her in the galley and press a kiss to her neck. In those early, blissfully simple days, the yacht was a place where death was an abstract concept, entirely separate from them. It was only later that death had crept onto their deck with a silent stealth. Chapter 14. Then. Standing barefoot on deck, Lana turned slowly on the spot, following the line of the horizon. It seemed to curve with her, vast and empty, broken only by the shimmering arc of the sun as it slipped away. The horizon was alight with flame orange and magenta tones, which feathered away into muted shades of rose, finally settling into a dusky navy behind her. The colours were mesmeric. It would take a lifetime of mixing paints to be able to capture half of that palette. She turned again, her toes pressing into the wooden deck, wind billowing through her cotton top. Ocean. Sky. No land. She breathed in deeply, filling her lungs with sea air so pure and salt-tinged that it tasted vital. It was their second day on passage, and somehow it felt different from the previous sailing they'd done. Out here, where the land disappeared and the open ocean surged up to greet them, Lana was aware of their vulnerability. A 50-foot yacht no longer felt sizable. It seemed no more than a fluttering leaf, twirling with the breeze. Lana had the visceral sensation that, except for the 5 other crew, she was entirely alone. There were no boats, no land, just the weight of the blue that they floated on, and the power of her sails to propel them forward. It was both intoxicating and terrifying. Even the sea had a different quality away from land. It seemed thicker, darker, more alive. In a sense, the sailing was easier. Aaron had set their course, and as the sea was steady, the winds fairly light, the autopilot was able to do most of the work. The crew's time was their own, to read, fish, practice yoga, cook, do as they pleased. She felt the vibration of footsteps through the deck, and turned to see Aaron moving towards the lifeline, his gaze locked searchingly on the horizon. Over the past few weeks, Lana had met other skippers and crews, some on private boats, others chartering guests, or sailing a yacht for the owner. And the majority of them managed their crews with a degree of formality, using precise sailing terms, holding daily briefings, insisting on dry passages, and that life jackets be worn everywhere on deck. Aaron's approach was different. There were few set procedures or formal briefings, and the crew worked together without needing to be specifically instructed. "Weather's been good so far," Lana called to Aaron. He looked startled, as if surprised to see her standing there. Sometimes it was as if he'd forgotten that he wasn't sailing on his blue adventure alone. "Can't complain," he said, turning back to the horizon. She wondered what he was looking for out there. What drew him so powerfully to the water? When she thought about his previous life in New Zealand, she could easily picture him as a barrister, with his sharp intelligence and strength of conviction, and his winning poker face that gave nothing away. Yet the courts were places of bricks and mortar set deep within cities, where suits and ties and polished leather shoes were worn. It was as if Aaron were two different people. The one who'd once lived in the city, with his dusty tomes of law books and smartly pressed suits, and the one with his sun-cracked lips, calloused hands, and a yacht he'd rigged to sail across oceans. It seemed that he'd let go of one life and simply stepped into another. "Feels strange having one less crew member, don't you think?" Lana said. He shrugged. "Crews come and go. You get used to it." All seemed quite sudden, Joseph deciding to leave like that. "Did it?" Lana kept returning to Denny and Aaron's conversation outside the internet cafe, wondering if it were entwined with Joseph's leaving. "It's odd. Joseph told me he had enough money to sail until New Zealand." Aaron turned and looked at her.
She knew no one liked having their authority questioned, but Lana had never been good at knowing when to stop. His tone was crisp as he said, "Maybe Joseph's only been telling you part of the story." "Or maybe," Lana thought, "you are." That evening, Lana sat alone at the helm, gazing up at a sky ablaze with stars. They rained from the black night so vividly that she felt as if she could stretch up and run her fingers through them. With the slow rolling motion of the yacht and the calming sound of water moving against the hull, she could feel her eyelids beginning to close. She shook her head briskly, knowing how important it was that she stayed alert. She was on the midnight till 2 a.m. watch, and although the autopilot was doing the work, Lana was still responsible for checking for other vessels and making sure they were keeping their course. She unclipped her safety harness and stood, circling her shoulders and stretching her neck from side to side. Although she was comfortable being alone on deck, she'd worn the harness because she didn't like the idea that if she were to trip and fall overboard, none of the crew would know until the next person came on watch. "Trying to keep awake?" Shell said, climbing up through the hatch carrying two mugs. "I made us hot chocolate. Thought you might need the energy boost," she said, passing one to Lana. Despite the warm air, after a while the wind and salt left her skin chilled, and she hadn't dared leave her post to fetch a jumper. The sweet warmth of the milky chocolate slid down her throat, and she sighed. "You are heaven sent." Lana settled herself at the helm, making room for Shell beside her. "What are you doing up?" "Couldn't sleep. Only another 20 minutes till my watch, so I figured I'd keep you company." "Perfect timing. I was just starting to hit the wall. Comes on sudden, doesn't it? How are you finding the watches?" The system was straightforward, with each of the crew taking a 2-hour solo watch on rotation throughout the day and night. Usually in the day, there were always several crew on deck at any one time, so the sense of responsibility lessened. But at night, you were very much alone. "I'm enjoying them," Lana said, then added, "when the weather's like this, at least." "There's something magical about the water at night. Everything feels mellowed." Shell took a sip of her hot chocolate. "Back home, Dad kept his sailing boat at the end of our jetty, and some evenings I'd sleep out there, just watching the stars."
"Sounds peaceful.
What's the shooting star count tonight?"
"We're well into double figures," Lana answered, thinking how blasé she was becoming to the spectacle of nature.
She'd barely been able to see the stars while living in the city, yet here the sky was bursting with them. The two of them fell into silence as they finished their hot chocolates. Shell set her empty cup between her knees, and Lana heard her slowly turning the bangles she wore on her wrist, rotating each one in turn like a rosary. Lana glanced across at her, sensing there was something Shell had come up here to talk about.
"How come you couldn't sleep?"
"Guess I just wasn't that tired." Lana waited, not asking anything further. Eventually, Shell said, "You and Kitty go back a long way."
"Since we were 11. She was telling me about living in London, trying to make it as an actress."
"It's a tough industry. Lots of people fighting for work."
"I bet she's brilliant."
"She was," Lana said, thinking of all the performances she'd watched. The moment Kitty walked onto the stage, the audience was utterly rapt. She had a presence about her, something that made people want to stop and watch. But what the audience never saw was Kitty pacing the dressing room beforehand, a bottle of vodka in her hand. No matter how many performances she aced or how many compliments were lavished upon her, she could never quite shake off her stage fright. "Must have been hard making the decision to leave it all behind and go travelling."
"You know, I think it was surprisingly easy. Coming away was the first thing that made clear sense.
For us both." "Did Kitty leave anyone behind? A partner?"
"No, no one."
Lana realized that this was what Shell had come up here to talk about.
She felt a bolt of annoyance at Kitty, who carelessly flirted with Shell whenever she craved the attention, pulling Shell onto her knee, asking her to apply her sunscreen, sunbathing topless together. But there was nothing more to it than that. Guess there's no imminent danger of me and Kitty breaking Erin's no-relationships rule, Shell said, trying to keep her tone light. Lana could hardly say that Kitty was only interested in women when there were men around to watch. Instead, she tried to deflect the remark by saying, "Seems a bit of an odd rule, don't you think?" "Lots of other skippers impose it. I guess they're worried about shifting loyalties or extra tensions between the crew." Lana could understand that. "So, Aaron's never had a girlfriend on the yacht?" "Never. 2.5 years he's been doing this. Surely he must get lonely." Shell said, "I'm pretty sure there was someone before the blue." Lana glanced at her, attention piqued. Shell lowered her voice as she said, "There was this night, we were in Thailand at the time, and we were all out drinking. Aaron was talking to me one moment, and the next he just stopped, and all the color seemed to drain from his face. I turned to see what had caught his attention and saw a woman walking into the bar. It was like, I don't know, as if Aaron could no longer hear us or even knew we were there. He just stared at this woman as she moved through the room. All of a sudden, Aaron was on his feet. As he approached her, the woman turned, and Aaron reared back as if he'd been slapped. She obviously wasn't who he'd been expecting. He didn't rejoin the rest of us, just left the bar and returned to the yacht. When we got back a few hours later, I went to check on him, and he was sitting on the floor of his cabin, an empty bottle of rum at his feet. He was in a bad way. He was sobbing, kept on talking to someone he called Lydia, telling her how much he missed her and loved her, and how sorry he was. "What did he say the next day?" Lana asked. "Nothing. He didn't come out of his cabin until the evening, and when he did, he never mentioned a thing, just carried on as before." "So who do you think Lydia is?" "I don't know, but I have a pretty strong feeling that she's got something to do with why he set sail out on the blue." Lana thought about this for a moment. "Aaron never talks about his past, does he?" Shell shook her head. "Maybe the blue was his way of escaping it." Lana nodded slowly, feeling as though Shell had touched on something important. "What about Joseph?" she asked. "You think Aaron threw him off?" "No," Shell answered without hesitation. "We always vote about who comes on board and who leaves. Aaron would never make a decision like that without talking to the rest of us. That's not how the blue works. It was Joseph's choice." She saw that Shell believed wholeheartedly in the blue's ideology. And in Aaron. Perhaps Lana was just a skeptic, but she wasn't convinced that everything was as democratic and transparent as Aaron would like them to believe. Chapter 15. Then. Dawn cast a weak orange light across the water. Lana's bare feet dangled towards the sea, swaying with the motion of the yacht. White plumes of spray kicked up into the air, but only a fizz of it struck her legs. Her loose hair whipped around her face, and she glanced at her wrists, looking for a spare hairband, but there wasn't one. She gathered her hair in one hand, and holding onto the lifeline with the other, she leant forward, staring down at the water as it parted around the bow. She liked sitting up here, for there was nothing in front of her except ocean and wind. Perhaps that's why Joseph had chosen to write here. You could only look forward, as everything else was blown behind you. Suddenly, the water split open, and the curve of a dolphin's back cut an arc through the air, glossy and dark. Lana's mouth opened in surprise. She watched as it jumped and dived through the wave created by the bow. She got to her feet, shouting to Denny, who was on watch at the stern, "Dolphins!" She heard his footsteps, light and fast, moving along the deck. He joined her at the bow, leaning over the lifeline. They both grinned as an entire pod, maybe 20 or so,
erupted from the water.
Just look at them, Lana said, astounded, as they cut through the waves,
then dropped back, diving and resurfacing playfully. Denny placed his arms around her waist and rested his chin on her shoulder. It was rare to find themselves alone on deck together, and she absorbed every moment of it, watching the pod until they finally disappeared. Lana thought about the life she would otherwise be leading. A desk and a headset. A 45-minute commute spent gazing through rain-smeared windows. Her daydreams doodled in the margins of an administration form. It was staggering to think of all those hours, weeks and months she'd given up to a life that didn't fulfill her. When across the world there was this. It scared her to think that she could so easily have missed it.
How do you go back after this?
Really, how can you ever be satisfied with your old life again? Lana asked.
That's the thing, Lana. You don't go back. You go forwards.
She liked that. You don't go back. You go forwards. She turned in the space of his arms to face him. In the early morning light, his face was deeply tanned, the pale blue irises looking sharper. She noticed how the ends of his eyelashes and his outer brows had been bleached by the sun, and she wanted to press her lips against them, taste the salt trapped there.
Travelling doesn't have to be an extended holiday from life, he said. Maybe you use the space to take a look at things from a different perspective. Work out what you want.
What? Go travelling to find yourself? She teased, an eyebrow cocked. She hooked a finger beneath the neckline of his T-shirt. You wearing a shark's tooth necklace beneath there? He laughed. You know, he said more seriously now, maybe having some time away is more about letting go of all the things you're not, becoming the person you were always meant to be.
When she first met Denny, it would have been easy to disregard him as another laid-back traveller, coasting from one good time to the next. But she was learning how much more there was to him. He'd carved a career out of his passion and found a way to do it, whilst maintaining a lifestyle of freedom and adventure. Denny had found what made him happy. Travel, friends, languages, freedom. And he'd built his life adhering to principles that kept those things as a priority. In contrast, Lana felt as if she'd rolled from one thing to the next, like a ball fired from a pinball machine, now bouncing from one edge to the other, with no control over where she ended up. Denny set his gaze squarely on her in his arms. So, Lana Lowe, what is it you want?
You, she thought. And for this to never end.
Footsteps sounded up on deck and Aaron appeared. In a flash, Denny had released Lana and stepped away from her.
Morning, Denny called, moving down the deck to greet Aaron.
Aaron looked tired as he settled his faded cap into place, then rubbed a hand across the side of his neck. If he'd noticed Lana standing at the bow, he didn't say anything.
What's the weather doing? Aaron asked. Southwesterlies still, Denny said. Steady force 4. Been cruising at 6 to 8 knots.
Aaron nodded again, looking up at the mainsail, which was reefed down to the first point.
Could make some good ground today, Denny said.
Aaron shoved his hands in his shorts pockets, turning and surveying the sea conditions.
Bit of cloud out east.
Denny nodded.
You think that low pressure system that was brewing in Micronesia has anything to do with that?
The forecast didn't show anything significant.
Aaron stared at the cloud for a long while, saying nothing more. Lana watched from the bow as Denny took a step towards Aaron, placing a hand on his shoulder. With his gaze on Aaron, he said something in a low voice that Lana couldn't make out. Aaron's expression didn't alter. He just remained as he was, looking out to sea. After a long time, Aaron said,
I need some coffee.
When he disappeared below deck, Lana moved slowly towards the cockpit, where Denny was checking their position on the navigation plotter. Is he okay?
Aaron? Yeah, fine. Probably just tired.
She nodded. You know, I've been thinking, she said, glancing over her shoulder towards the latch. Maybe we should have a chat to Aaron. About us? See what he says?
Denny's eyes widened.
I don't think that's a good idea.
Why not?
He's made the rule, Lana. He's not going to budge.
So what do we do?
Maybe I like sneaking around, stealing kisses, he said, placing his lips on her neck.
Maybe you'd like it more if I could share that great big double bed you've been hogging in your cabin, she said with a small smile.
I would like that, he grinned.
Then let's talk to him.
He rubbed a hand along the back of his neck. It's not the right time. Not on passage.
She remembered the remark Kitty had made about Denny when they'd been provisioning, implying that it was convenient for him to keep their relationship quiet.
Will there be a right time? She challenged. Look, he said, his voice lowered. Aaron's got a lot on his mind at the moment. Bringing this sort of thing up with him isn't a good idea right now.
Why do you care so much about what he thinks?
I know how Aaron works, and I want to approach this in the right way. Trust me when I say the right way isn't now.
His expression was set as he said, Let's wait till we reach Palau. Think about things when we're on land. She had been willing to break one of the Blues' rules because, in her mind, Denny was worth the risk. But as she replayed his reluctance to make their relationship official, and the swift way he turned from her when Aaron had come up on deck, she wondered whether Denny saw things differently.
Sure, let's leave it till we're on land, she said curtly.
She slipped out of his grasp and disappeared below deck. She paced through the galley towards the bathroom and wrenched open the door. Shit! Sorry, she called, realizing someone was in there. Turning to leave, she hesitated as her mind began to process what she'd just seen. Slowly, she pulled the door open again. Her eyes widened. What the... Joseph was standing with his back to the sink. He held a finger to his lips, then pulled her into the bathroom, shutting the door behind her.
What are you doing here? You left the boat, she whispered frantically. Do the others know?
No one. They stood face to face in the tiny confines of the bathroom. Up close, she could see the cracked skin on his lips and a dusting of grey hairs spouting prematurely at his temples.
Aaron is going to go mad when he finds out. Where have you been hiding?
Sail locker.
She was stunned. The sail locker was right in the very bow of the yacht, accessed through Heinrich's cabin, and there was only enough space to lie flat. It would be like locking yourself in a coffin. She had no idea how he'd managed to stay hidden for the 2 days they'd been on passage.
How did you get back on board? We all said goodbye.
A banker dropped me off while you were at immigration.
Why are you here?
I have nothing else, Lana, he said, his gaze lowering. This, the boat, the crew, it may not seem much, but for me, is very much.
Slowly she nodded. She understood. What are you eating? Are you getting enough water?
I have supply, yes.
She wiped a hand across her brow, thinking about the lengths Joseph had gone to in order to stay on board. Then a new thought hit her.
You didn't clear out. When we arrive in Palau, immigration won't let you in.
I will explain.
You'll explain? They're not going to like it. Jesus! She said. Neither is Aaron.
Then he will have to turn us back.
Aaron wouldn't do that, and Joseph knew it. If they turned back now, it would mean they'd be days behind schedule, and then could be delayed in the Philippines as they waited for another weather window.
You...
A knock at the door startled them both.
Lana, is that you?
Denny called. She looked despairingly at Joseph, who opened his hands, saying,
They have to find out at some point.
She unlocked the door and faced Denny.
Listen, I just wanted...
He stopped.
Joseph? What the hell?
Before anyone had a chance to explain, there was the heavy tread of footsteps along the passageway. Aaron's walk was distinctive. Powerful, firm strides that made the floor vibrate. He stopped alongside Denny, and Lana watched his expression change as he saw Joseph, the muscles in his jaw tightening, his lips pulling back over his teeth. He enunciated each word acutely as he demanded,
What the fuck are you doing on my yacht?
Surprise, Joseph said dryly.
Lana closed her eyes, feeling the tension knotted in the tops of her shoulder blades.
You fucking idiot.
Aaron's glare was poisonous.
You have no idea what you've done.
He looked at Lana.
Wanna tell me what's going on?
She realized that Denny was staring at her too. I just came in and, well, Joseph was here. Lana wanted to get out of the bathroom, but Aaron was blocking the doorway. She pressed herself against the bulkhead, feeling the varnished wood against her back. Joseph began to smile. Lana couldn't tell whether it was a reaction to the tension or whether he was genuinely thrilled by what was happening. Aaron took a step forward, putting only inches between himself and Joseph.
You, Aaron said, pointing at him, had better wipe that fucking smirk off your face. You got any idea how serious this is? As skipper, I am legally responsible for everyone on this yacht. I didn't clear you out. That means immigration think you're still in the Philippines. If I turn up with you in Palau, it's as good as smuggling you in.
I will explain there was error, and I will pay you. Pay you double.
I don't want your fucking money.
I thought that was why I could not stay on your yacht, no?
Lana heard the challenge in Joseph's tone. Aaron's hand shot forward, and he seized Joseph by the neck, thrusting him up against the bulkhead, narrowly missing the towel hook nailed into the wood.
Do not push me.
The wood creaked behind Joseph's head as colour rose in his face.
We both know why I wanted you to get the fuck off my yacht. You're lucky I'm not beating the fucking shit out of you.
Aaron spat through gritted teeth, his lips twisting around his words. Denny reached forward, placing a hand firmly on Aaron's shoulder.
We can work this out, he said calmly.
Aaron's expression remained taut. He leant in close to Joseph's ear, and in a low, deadly voice said,
Don't forget, I know you, Joseph. I know what you are.
Chapter 16. Now.
Lana realizes that she hasn't eaten since yesterday evening. She drifts back through the port and returns to the lobby of the main building, where she remembers seeing a vending machine. She stands in front of the glass box, which houses rows of crisps, chocolates and nuts, and sees her own hollow-eyed reflection glaring back at her. She still can't believe that Denny is gone. Behind her, the double doors into the building push open, and she hears the click of high heels along the corridor. The sound makes her think of Kitty walking with her arm threaded through Lana's when they were teenagers, their hair straightened, lipstick painted on, sauntering in a cloud of Kitty's perfume. A memory flashes in her mind like a camera bulb, the two of them hiding in the theatre green room after drama class. The lights had gone out, and they heard the door clank shut. and then they were encased with reels of dusty costumes and tired theatre props. Lana felt a giggle swelling in her throat, and she bit down on her lip, waiting for their teacher's footsteps to recede. Beside her in the darkness, she could feel Kitty's shoulders beginning to shake against hers, their acrylic school jumpers crackling together with static. Laughter began building in Lana's chest, bubbling up through her throat, and finally bursting from her mouth an explosion of gasps and howls. When their drama teacher had taken out her mobile and called her husband, telling him to come home early as she had a surprise for him, she hadn't been aware that there were two pairs of ears listening from behind the props box. Lana could barely catch her breath as she staggered towards the doorway. She felt along the wall and flicked the switch, the cold strip lights buzzing on. As her eyes adjusted, she saw that Kitty had pulled on the nearest costume, a horse's head with huge yellow teeth and a flapping dark mane, and was sitting on a stool, legs crossed, pretending to smoke a cigar.
"So, a horse comes into a bar," Kitty said, in her best New York accent. "And the bartender asks, 'Hey, why the long face?'"
More laughter pealed from Lana's mouth. After the two of them had tried on and twirled around in various other outfits, vicars, sailors, angels, and chimney sweeps, Lana flopped down onto a bed of blue sheets that had been used to represent the sea in last term's production of The Tempest.
"Shall we bother going back to lessons?" Lana said, staring at the ceiling, amber hair fanning out beneath her.
"No,"
Kitty said, lying back too, the smell of her body spray overpowering the musty sheets.
"Let's just stay here and pretend we're somewhere sunny and beautiful."
"Greece?"
"Further."
"Australia?"
"Yes, Australia. And the sea is warm and clear, and there are bare-chested boys bringing us ice-cold drinks."
"I like it here," Lana grinned.
"When we leave school," Kitty said, rolling onto her side and looking at Lana, "let's get away from here."
Lana had turned towards her, their noses inches apart, their breath warm against each other's face.
"We can't stay around here forever. I don't want that to happen to us, Lana. I don't want us to end up working on the tills or at the social club.
I want more than that," Kitty said emphatically. "I want you to be a brilliant artist," she said with a flourish, "and for me to be a famous actress. I want us to have adventures."
"We will," Lana promised her. But even then, she'd never believed it. People on their street didn't become renowned artists or actresses. They worked in shops, pubs and cafes, and they were the lucky ones.
The staccato clacks of high heels grow closer, stopping behind Lana. She turns and is immediately struck by the elegance of the young woman before her. She is wearing a long beige summer coat, which, on someone else, could look drab, but instead looks sophisticated and fashionable. Her dark hair is swept into a low bun, and there is a touch of colour to her lips, making her pale skin appear even smoother. Although Lana has never met this woman before, she somehow looks familiar. Her dark eyes search Lana's face.
"I am wondering if you would help. Is this correct building for search and rescue?"
A strange heat pinches Lana's cheeks as she hears a European accent.
"Yes, it's the Maritime Rescue Centre."
She pauses, looking closely at the woman. "Are you here about the blue?"
"Yes, the blue that sink. I am waiting for information about someone. My brother. I think he was a passenger on a yacht that is in problem."
Lana blinks rapidly, suddenly placing her accent.
"French."
A chill shivers down her spine.
"Your brother?"
The woman nods. Lana knows exactly what is coming. She tries to swallow, to fill her lungs with air, to prepare herself. The young French woman says,
"His name is Joseph."
Sweat prickles across Lana's skin. She feels the ground softening beneath her feet, feels her mind lilting. Joseph had a sister. And she's here, standing in front of Lana. It's not possible. Joseph said he had no family. She remembers the conversation clearly. She stares aghast at this woman. Joseph's sister touches the back of her bun. A quick, uncomfortable gesture. Then, you have someone you love on board also? Lana seems only able to gape. She is aware of how strange she must appear. Simply moving her lips around the words, yes, a friend of mine, seems to dissipate all her energy. Joseph's sister inclines her head, as if expecting more. But Lana cannot manage anything further. Joseph's sister waits, her eyes on Lana. What happened to the yacht? It sink, I am told. Lana nods her head a little. It hit a container, put a hole in the side of the boat.
Have the people been rescued?
No, no, not yet. Joseph's sister nods, then pushes her hand deep into her coat pocket. Lana's heart is hammering against her ribcage. This cannot be happening. She wants to ask, why did Joseph tell us he had no family? What are you doing in New Zealand? How did you hear about the blue? What do you know? She manages to compose herself enough to ask, so, you're in New Zealand to meet your brother? A small, sad smile emerges on the woman's lips.
Yes, I am. But it is, I don't know how to say, difficult with us.
Lana waits.
Months ago, my brother wrote to me, telling me about the blue.
She pronounces the name of the yacht in the same way as Joseph, as if their tongues are only lightly brushing over the words. He left his home, Paris, because he had troubles.
He needed to be, free of himself, I think. In his letter, he described the yacht so beautifully, yes?
Her expression softens as she said,
that she swept through the water, that there were people on board who he knew would become his friends, that he was going to sail with her to New Zealand. He wrote that he would like me to be here when the boat docked.
She removes her hands from her pockets and clasps them together.
So I come all the way from Paris to meet him. I ring the port this morning to ask when exactly the boat is meant to arrive, but they tell me this news instead. I hope that he is safe.
I hope that he is safe. A dark panic builds in the pit of Lana's stomach. She feels it reaching into her throat, squeezing tight around her voice box. She wants to turn, to run, to not have this conversation, to not think of what happened to Joseph.
We have to hope, don't we, that they will all be returned safely,
Joseph's sister says. The blood drains from Lana's face. She already knows that the search and rescue team will not be bringing in Joseph. He is anything but safe.